You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and we're really pleased to have with me once again John Rubino, the proprietor of DollarCollapse.com. And John is, well, he's been a very quite frequent guest on this show and a really good friend. Everybody knows John Rubino, I think. I have never found somebody that doesn't like him. He's very personable, but he's very smart. So, you know, he can be a nice person, but John has both the smarts and he's a good guy and people really like him. So that's one reason to have him on. But frankly, I think most of our listeners are interested in making money. And if it's a nasty bugger or someone who's really nice like John, they don't care. They want to make money. But it's good to have both. Thanks for joining me again, John.
Hey, Jay. Good intro. Thank you. and this is a really good day for us to talk because there is a lot going on out there that is meaningful.
Oh, my goodness. Is there ever? So let's get into it. Just like to sort of we've titled today's show Profiting from the Coming Dollar Collapse. That's the title of your book, written back in 2004 by you and James Turk. And, you know, I'm just wondering, back at that time, 2004, did you have a time in mind for the dollar survival? And would have you thought it would last this long at that point in time?
Yeah, we did have a time frame, 2005. Uh-huh. That was when we thought everything was going to fall apart. Uh-huh. Actually, the biggest stressor for James and I when we were writing that book was that we were afraid we were going to be too late, that we would come to market and the global financial system would already have fallen apart before the book came out. You know, so that's how tenuous the world seemed back then. You know, we were already, people forget now that already by the early 2000s, we were the biggest debtor nation in the history of the human race. Mm-hmm. And we were making all the mistakes that previous countries made right before hyperinflation's hit. So we were in that kind of a spot back then. And here we still are. You know, we have not completely blown up yet. And, you know, I think the explanation for that in retrospect is that this is a global inflation, mm-hmm. global debt binge. And we've got all the central banks of the world operating with fiat currencies, which is to say unlimited printing presses, and that gave them tools that no previous system has ever had for manipulating markets and for mm-hmm. fooling people into thinking things are basically okay when they're absolutely not. But even that, you know, even a global fiat currency system has limits, and it feels like we're bumping up against some of those limits now at long last.
Mm-hmm. When you say we were the largest debtor nation, is that based on our national debt or is that based on our trade deficits? Because we've been running huge trade deficits, hemorrhaging dollars, if you will, whereas some of the, you know, the creditor nations, the nations that have been selling more to us than we buy from them, turn around and buy our treasuries, or at least were until now, the largest debtor nation on the basis of the national debt, I suppose.
Well, on the basis of total debt, because you can't total just debt. Look at government debt. Yeah. If you're trying to gauge the financial health of a system, because, you know, governments can, like we did in the 1990s, they can convince the private sector to borrow huge amounts of money, which generates taxable income, which lowers the government's need to borrow, and therefore you can even run surpluses while in the middle of a debt binge. And we did that in the 1990s. We actually ran some surpluses, but the private sector was conned into taking on so much money that our total debt went through the roof. So by the early 2000s, the total debt in the U.S. economy was higher than any country's ever in history. Mm-hmm. And the per capita debt was right up there. And like you said, the trade deficit that we were running mm-hmm. was the biggest ever. So we were running record levels of debt and borrowing and leverage wherever you looked. You know, and that doesn't include unfunded liabilities and derivatives, which are vastly bigger now than they have ever been in history, you know, because there wasn't even a derivatives market until just lately. And now it's approaching $1 quadrillion notional value. And unfunded liabilities were also unheard of 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now they dwarf the official national debt. You know, what Medicare actually owes mm-hmm. is bigger than what the U.S. government actually owes.
So it's a absolutely just astronomical issue, no doubt about it. So I guess what you're saying is the system has lasted, the dollar system has lasted this long in part because of this globalization sort of spreading the risk out, socializing it around the globe in a way. To me, another part of it, John, and this is why I ask about the export, the trade balances, the trade imbalances, the trade deficits, is because up until recent years, it didn't matter that we were buying more than we were selling to other countries because the people that sold us more were taking the dollars they earned and buying our treasuries, recycling them into treasuries. From what I can see, that's largely stopping now. That's largely not happening. The major exporters are not recycling dollars to buy our treasuries, which now means that the Fed has to print money to buy a large percentage of our debt.
Yeah, we've entered the next stage of the process, which is self-financing, you know, where we just create new dollars and fund the government with it. You know, that's the definition of modern monetary theory. That's that's a theory that's considered still to be kind of fringe, but functionally we're already doing it. Because, for instance, the Treasury will issue a bunch of debt to fund the government. The Fed buys that debt with newly created dollars, and then it rebates the interest paid on that debt back to the Treasury. So, in effect, the Fed is just creating new dollars and funding the government with it, so which is modern monetary theory. So we're towards the end of the process. You know, that this also happened to governments in the past when they were destroying their currencies, where they get to the point where they're just creating new currency to keep the government running. You know, their taxes really don't finance them anymore. They have to just create a lot of new currency. And that's usually a prelude to a collapse in the currency's value, because people figure it out eventually that you know, that the government is just printing new currency at an accelerating rate and using that currency to fool everybody into thinking things are okay. And once people realize that, they bail on the currency. You know, they use their currency to buy real things that governments can't inflate away. And you get the crack-up boom or the Minsky moment or whatever term you want to use for it, which is basically this discontinuity at the end of a gigantic credit bubble. When, you know, yesterday means nothing to tomorrow. There's no linearity anymore in the system. It goes nonlinear. And, you know, we're following that script. We're just following it much more slowly than any other crack-up boom has ever unfolded. But we're doing all the stuff, and we're seeing all the effects that other systems have seen when they tried something this stupid.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, John, people will say, well, we've heard from guys, you know, Taylor, you've been talking about the dollar's collapse for since you started writing your newsletter in 1981, Jay, you know, this guy Turk and Rubino and, you know, a bunch of other guys, we hear them talking all the time about the dollar collapse, and we're talking about gold going to umpteen thousands of dollars, but it doesn't happen. So, Taylor, don't. So are you saying that the handwriting is on the wall, in essence, by some of these things? If we look back historically, I know we hear from Alistair MacLeod, who likes to compare what we're going through now with John Law's Mississippi Bubble, in which the Central Bank of France had to print money to try to prop up the Mississippi Company, which was essentially the French economy at that time. And so it did it until people lost confidence, and then the Mississippi Company wasn't making any money. And so people started losing confidence, and so they had to start printing money to buy the shares to keep the con game going. And then ultimately it collapsed, of course. You see something like that happening, and then this notion that trillions upon trillions, I mean, it's not just, I looked at your most recent article here, which I would suggest to our listeners, you go to Dollar Collapse and read it. After 50 years of fiat currency, guess what looks good? John, it's an excellent article, but as I look at some of these charts here, you know, we're talking exponential, aren't we? I mean, it's like exponential doesn't last very long.
No, exponential change cannot go on for very long, and we are in the exponential phase of all this. You know, basically, what you were saying about the John Law, back in the 1700s in France. We're doing virtually the same thing. He had to create new currency. He was basically the chairman of the Fed and the Treasury Secretary of France at that time, you know, so he had the power to do all this stuff. But what we're doing now is creating a ton of new currency to prop up our financial markets, just as the French tried to do back then.
Right.
Because the bond market would collapse without the Fed buying billions and billions and billions of dollars every month of new treasury issuance. The stock market would totally collapse if we could not keep interest rates low by buying bonds. So that what we're doing now is basically exactly what you described from 18th century France, only we're doing it on a scale that's just so off the charts. You know, the South Sea bubble could fit into J.P. Morgan Chase's prop trading desk very comfortably. You know, they could handle that whole thing.
Yeah.
So what we're doing now is just so much bigger than anything that's been done before mathematically.
Massive and, scale.
Yeah. And so when it blows up, it's hard to even imagine what happens when the whole world tips over the way it's going to. I mean, this isn't just the U.S. You know, we're talking about the dollar and everything, but the euro is in the same boat. The yen is in the same boat. Even the Chinese yuan and pound sterling, you know, all the big currencies, with a very possible exception of the Swiss franc, are going the same way. They're falling off the same cliff at some point. And you know, the timing, obviously, you and I don't get to predict the timing of something like this anymore, but we're clearly heading in that direction. So if you want to invest money in this world, it makes sense to try to position yourself for that eventuality. In other words, to protect yourself and your family and maybe profit from a big financial discontinuity when nothing works anymore. And so that's the gold story, basically, because that's the thing that for the last 5,000 years has worked, no matter what we threw at it, revolution, natural disaster, crazy new political philosophy, whatever, financial crash, gold has held its value that whole time. So that's the logical place to be, with a few other possibilities thrown in, like possibly cryptos, definitely farmland, maybe a good rental house here and there, you know, things like that that governments can't make more of. And very possibly shorting some of these big stocks at some point in the not too distant future. You know, watch the movie The Big Short.
Yeah.
And you see that timing is hard, but the rewards are astounding if you catch a bubble right near the peak, you know, and I don't know. We could talk, if we have time, about the specific things that are happening today, which that imply that the bubble is near to bursting.
Well, I think so. I mean, starting with Joe Biden's enormous amounts of trillions upon trillions that he wants to spend, and the Democrats, I guess, believe modern monetary theory. They haven't looked at John Law's Mississippi bubble. They haven't looked at these other disasters of the past. In fact, I think that Alistair likes to compare John Law with John Maynard Keynes in terms of, he says Law was, you know, Law beat Keynes to this con game, essentially. Anyway, it seems to work, right? And as long as it works until it doesn't. And people have realized that the Fed had its back in the equity markets. If, you know, it's like Michael saying, well, you know, fat chance the Fed's going to really taper anything seriously. They're going to keep pumping money into the system. So then I guess the question is, why would it break down? At the same time, Michael's saying he thinks we're seeing a topping of the equity market, and he thinks that he believes very strongly that the big guys that have been holding the NASDAQ up that are really about to topple over. So what causes it to happen, John? In other words, why can't the party go on forever? What are the dynamics and physics that keep it from happening?
Well, exponentially growing systems cannot go on forever because they take more and more. If you're not talking about just finance, but exponential systems in general, they take more and more energy over time. They require more and more energy in order to operate optimally. But as you reach a point where there's just not enough new energy to put into the system, that's when they blow up frequently. So we're at the point now where the amount of money, new money that has to be created to keep the system running right, is so immense that you reach a limit. Can you just create $10 trillion a year, year after year after year, and just dump it into the system? Probably not. And so what's happening right now is very interesting, because it's important to point out that the system is so fragile now that it can't handle a normal garden variety recession slash bear market. If we just had a normal, 1982 kind of downturn where it's tough, but totally survivable, it wouldn't be survivable this time because we're so financially fragile. But here's what's happening right now. The Fed is starting to talk about tapering, which normally tanks the stock market anyhow. Meanwhile, you've got slowing growth. Retail sales were actually down in the last month, and home sales are starting to plateau after a huge spike in prices, at least in that market. Consumer sentiment just cratered. Now that the stimmy checks aren't going out anymore, all of a sudden, consumers are not nearly as optimistic as they were, and they're scaling back their buying plans, which is why retail sales are down. And stocks, meanwhile, just hit an all-time high yesterday. And then Afghanistan. we've got this thing going on geopolitically that makes us look incompetent and weak. And, a fiat currency is a psychological construct. It only exists and only has value because the people in charge are perceived to be competent and honest. And I know that's a stretch in any event for the U.S. government these last 20 or 30 years. But now, more so than ever, it's a huge stretch because we're just flailing around geopolitically. We really don't know what we're doing in the world. And President Biden is not somebody who can explain it in a way. He's not Ronald Reagan. He can't come out and make a speech that is just perfect and convinces everybody that we're on the right track. So the world is looking at the U.S. right now and thinking, wow, do I really want to own all these dollars? Because look at that. That's the country with the world's reserve currency, really? So, you throw all that together, and it's very possible that everyone's stocks are tanking today, right? So they're doing what you would expect them to do, given all the stuff I just talked about.
Yeah.
So, it's possible that we're rolling over now.
Yeah, certainly. And I know Alistair likes to talk about the enormous amounts, and I can't remember the numbers right now, but the amount of money, the amount of dollars that are still held by foreigners, it's very large. And so if those dollars came onto the market, it certainly could hurt the dollar. I know that just talking, Jim Rickards was saying much of what you were saying in an article I just read by him, talking about the weakness in the global economy, and not the least of which is China as well. So, but his view is that the Fed and the Biden administration doesn't seem to realize how weak the economy is, and so this idea of at least talking about tapering and letting interest rates rise. I don't know. It may be spooking the market. Maybe that's the start of it. But another interesting thing that Michael just mentioned, John, was that this time when they mentioned tapering, gold went up. So his thinking is maybe people are looking out ahead. The smart money is looking out ahead and saying, okay, go ahead and taper. Then what are you going to do? You're going to just print enormous amounts of money. So maybe that's what some of the smart money is thinking, is gold has bounced off, I think, $125 off its recent low. So I'm not sure what it's doing right now, but it's...
Well, in each of the previous taper tantrums, when the Fed tried to taper and then the stock market tanked and the Fed had to take it back and ease again, gold got sucked down along with everything else. Mm-hmm. So it could, but then it rocketed as soon as the Fed said, oh, did I say I was going to taper? Never mind. I meant I was going to cut interest rates and ramp up QE. Well, maybe people are just looking ahead and thinking, all right, well, the risk is that gold drops by 10% during the turmoil. But then the profitability, the profit potential is 30 or 40 or 50% when it takes off from the bottom. So why not just buy it now? So people could be looking ahead to the Fed's capitulation. That would be a reasonable thing to do.
Right. John, one very interesting chart in your article, after 50 years of fiat currency, guess what looks good? The last page, the last chart on your article. And folks, you should go to dollarcollapse.com, read John's article, this one as well as many others that he writes, and articles that he posts there from other excellent writers as well. John, this is a chart, Gold Bull Markets chart, that shows where we're at now relative to where we've been in the past. For example, the 1976-1980, we're a long ways away from the value of gold at that peak, and we're about maybe halfway there. Would you care to comment on where do you think, I think it's silly to try to say, ask the question, where will gold, how high will gold go? Because we're measuring it in dollars. It's almost a meaningless unit of measure, isn't it?
Yeah, and it has been going up. I mean, gold was $200 and some an ounce at the beginning of this century. Now mm-hmm. it's $1,700 and some. So it has done exactly what it was supposed to do during that time. But it's done it in a way that's left, because it's done it with long boring stretches, mm-hmm. interspersed yeah. with brief jumps. And so it's left a lot of people very frustrated. But yeah, if you look at this chart, you see that gold has about doubled in this bull market. But previous bull markets had gold going up between 400% and 500%. Mm-hmm. So we're in the very early stages, if you can use the past as prologue. Mm-hmm. We're in the very early stages of a much bigger move. You know, a 400% move starting at $1,000 or so an ounce means $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce in the not too distant future for gold. If we, if we follow past patterns, so. That's what we have to look forward to. And even if there are some squiggles along the way, I think that owning something that's going to end up, very probably, end up three or four times higher than it is today within the next, 5 to 6, 7 years, is a good thing to do when you consider the safety aspects of gold and silver. You know, the one thing they're not going to do is go down to zero. They will mm-hmm. always retain quite a bit of value, whereas there's no stock you can say that about out there. Stocks, in this, it was another article that I posted that I think had a really important idea in it about the Wall Street Journal's article yes. where they trashed yes. gold yeah. because it's not an inflation hedge, because they compared it to equities uh-huh. over the past 50 years, and equities had gone up a little bit more than gold during that time. So they said, basically, in effect, equities are a better inflation hedge than gold, which makes no sense, because uh-huh. gold is money. It is not an investment. So you right. compare gold with the dollar. And when you do that, you see that gold has vastly outperformed the other fiat currencies in the world, which means it's done its job. You know, it's a form of money that holds its value. It is not Amazon stock or Bitcoin or something like that. They're completely different things, and they compete in completely different areas. If you want something that outperforms Amazon, maybe you find a good mining stock, a gold miner. But the gold itself should hold its value over long periods of time. And it was really frustrating to see the Wall Street Journal not understanding that. Mm-hmm. You know, if they don't, nobody in the mainstream financial community is going to, mm-hmm. which just shows you how much outside generalist money is going to pour into precious metals once people get a clue, once people who are reading the Wall Street Journal and do not understand how precious metals and sound money in general work, once they figure it out, there will be none left for them, but the prices they'll be willing to pay will be outrageous.
Well, indeed. And you show another chart in that same article comparing the money supply with gold, and it looks like it's got a long ways to go, gold has, on the upside, but even more so silver. Maybe with 30 seconds left here, you can just comment on silver.
Yeah, silver wins twice. One is that it's a more volatile version of gold, basically. So in good times, it goes up more than gold. And it's an industrial metal that is used in a lot of clean tech. So to the extent that the world is pouring money into solar panels and electric cars, silver benefits. So you win twice with silver, and there's zero chance of silver ever being confiscated. So I own more silver than gold because of all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly makes sense. John, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us. Tell people to go to dollarcollapse.com, because there's so many good things there. I didn't get a chance to ask you about this repo chart in your article. Take a couple of seconds. I see we might have a few more seconds. What's up with this overnight reverse repo market?
Well, the short version is that the banks no longer want to lend money to each other because they know how the banking industry works, and they're terrified. You know, if the other banks are doing what they're doing, they don't want any part of it. So the government has had to step in, or the Federal Reserve has had to step in and lubricate the overnight lending market for the big banks. And it's up to like $1 trillion now.
Right,
yeah, it's crazy high number.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. John, we do have to go now. But yeah, it's the idea is that who wants to lend money at zero interest rates? You got to get some interest rate that will allow you to make up for the losses, because they will come when you lend money. So anyway, John, thank you so much for your time. Always good to have you with us. Your insights are very much valued by our listeners, so I thank you very much. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Lynn Alden will be with me, as well as Quentin Henning, to discuss SK Gold, a very exciting story that I think you're going to want to hear. And, of course, Lynn always has some great insights into the markets as well. So until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
NV Gold Corporation, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in Nevada with an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2021, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors, a globally recognized technical team, report coverage from industry gold experts, and a strong treasury. Visit NVGoldCorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.